and welcome, listeners of Undisclosed. Rabia here. This week, we're going to be doing something a little bit different with the addendum. If you listen to this week's episode 3 of The State versus Sean Thomas, you will have heard excerpts of my interview with attorney Larry Krasner, who is the Democratic frontrunner for the DA's election coming up in Philadelphia. And we had a really great, long, in-depth conversation. And so this week, we decided what we'll do is we'll run the entire interview so you can hear about all the issues that are happening in that city and some of the changes that Mr. Krasner is proposing for that city and what he's bringing to this race. And I thought this was really important to do because, you know, people a lot of times feel kind of helpless. Like, how do we challenge the system? And I think what's happening in Philadelphia is a brilliant challenge to the system, because what's happening is you're bringing in somebody who is coming in from the other side of the aisle. You're bringing in somebody who's a criminal defense attorney for his entire life, civil rights attorney for his entire career, and who has, you know, challenged the Philadelphia DA's office dozens of times, the police dozens of times. He understands the impacts that the policies of these institutions have on defendants, on the system. And so, you know what? I hope that he's not the only one who takes up this baton. And I hope across the country, we see more and more folks like Mr. Krasner enter these races. So without further ado, let's take a listen to the interview. So welcome to Undisclosed, Mr. Krasner. Thank you so much for taking time out of your, I'm sure, very, very busy campaign schedule right now to join us.
Happy to be here, but you can call me Larry.
All right. Thank you so much, Larry. You know, I've told our listeners a little bit about, you know, giving them a few points from your bio, but I really want to start by asking you to tell us more about your career and how and why, as a Stanford-educated attorney, you chose public service, civil rights, and criminal defense as your field of practice.
So let me see. I came out in 87, and then I was a state public defender in Philadelphia, meaning a county public defender in Philly for 3 years, and a federal defender in Philly for 2 years. And then I went into private practice, where I've been ever since, doing civil rights and criminal defense in criminal court 4 to 5 days a week, mostly in state court in various counties, especially Philly, but also have done a few hundred federal criminal matters and a lot of civil rights cases as well, mostly in federal court. Why did I do it? Because it's fun.
It's fun, is it really?
Yeah, because it's fun.
I practiced immigration and civil rights for over a decade, and I found it really emotionally trying.
It is, but that doesn't stop it from being fun. You know, I am not well suited to sitting in an office and tooling away for Exxon. I am better suited to interacting with people, both in and out of a courtroom, and enjoying in my own way their fascinating slice of life. And so it's just, I don't know, maybe it's the storyteller in me, but it's just what I wanted to do, and it's what makes me whole. So that's why I did it.
So, you know, in your decades of practice, you must have had a lot of interaction with the Philadelphia DA's office. So what was your kind of experience with them?
Not great. The reality is that the Philadelphia DA's office has been transfixed by almost a stat-driven approach of trying to charge as many people as possible with the biggest charges possible, get the biggest convictions possible for the longest sentences possible. That has been their modus operandi. I have referred to it at various times as kind of a sports mentality where, you know, you're trying to run up the score as high as possible, and that's clearly not what they should be doing.
Is this like their policy? Like, there's a certain number of statistics, convictions, prosecutions that are expected of the attorneys there, or is kind of a practice more so?
I think it's a practice, which is their politics. There's some very interesting articles that talk about how during the time period when being a district attorney became a stepping stone to becoming a governor or a U.S. senator or a president, incarceration increased. And I think there's a very clear relation between watching the Arlen Specters, who was district attorney in Philadelphia, and the Ed Rendells, who was district attorney in Philadelphia, and the others who may not be as high achieving but aspired no less, like Lynn Abraham and Seth Williams. I think there's a very direct correlation between the motivations of a politician like that to become a DA on the way to something else and mass incarceration and this almost metrics of, I guess they would call it justice. I would call it harm.
Well, what motivated you then to run for this position?
Because, you know, 30 years into my career, I was looking at more of the same. There were several candidates running, and I knew most of them very well. I knew what they stood for and what they didn't stand for. And frankly, what was coming out of their mouths is not what their careers reflected. And I was tired of it. You know, it's at 56 years of age, I had seen things getting worse and worse, mass incarceration getting worse and worse. We weren't any safer as a consequence, and I decided to run.
Well, your opponent said that, you know, we already have one public defender's office in Philadelphia, and we don't need a district attorney to be a second one. And on top of that, the city's former prosecutors, some of them published a letter in the Philadelphia Citizen before the primary calling you a radical candidate with no experience prosecuting crime. So what's your response? I mean, does it make sense for somebody who has no experience, as they're saying, prosecuting crime, somebody who's worked on the defense side, to become the top prosecutor of the city?
Well, I mean, look, let's be as direct as we can. I think anyone who has actually been in the system for a long time knows that the more difficult job on any average day is to be the defense lawyer. It is the defense lawyer who has to take the words of a prosecution witness from their own mouth and through those words show that there may be inaccuracy or there may be untruthfulness. That's not just my opinion. That's the opinion of a lot of ex-prosecutors I know who have been defense lawyers, and some of whom have gone back to being prosecutors. It's a tougher job, and it's a job that you have to wage with your fingernails, and you have to wage with your will in a way that prosecutors, you know, working off a 50-some million dollar budget with thousands of police officers at their disposal, don't have to, you know, they don't have to work as hard to achieve. So I don't accept the notion that if you come out of law school and you pursue criminal justice and you take an oath to uphold the Constitution and seek justice, and you happen to be really good at it and you win a whole heck of a lot of cases doing something that, to my mind, is not always but usually more difficult, I don't accept the notion that that's not relevant experience. I mean, the truth is I came out of law school and I applied both to prosecutors' offices and public defender's offices, and I came from a pretty fancy law school, and I had a ton of offers all over the country. Philly was a place where I couldn't be a prosecutor because Philly was drunk on the death penalty and, frankly, drunk on another whole pack of problems that persist in that office and flow from the Frank Rizzo era. And so it was not a place where I could have been a DA. I could have been a DA with Liz Holtzman in Brooklyn if I matched the time and the location. And there were other DA's offices in the country where I could have done it that were more progressive and more ethical than this one. But I chose to become a public defender in Philly, not because I was somehow born with a defense lawyer gene, but because that is where I could fit. And that's where the work really needed to be done, because the system was so unfair, due in large part to the culture of the DA's office.
Would you say that, I mean, this is something that I've been thinking about. We have millions of listeners, and many of them have reached out to us and said, you know, because of your podcast and the exposure of all these systematic issues and criminal justice, you know, we've decided to go to law school, or I'm in law school and I've decided to become a criminal defense attorney. Does it then make sense for people who are going to be graduating from law school, who believe that the system needs reforms, who are more progressive minded, to then actually become prosecutors instead of defense attorneys?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the people who are driving the criminal justice reform movement nationally are actually ex-prosecutors, or they are people who have done both. And we cannot, as a society, accept the definition of prosecutor that has been given to us by Lynn Abraham, because that is her idea of a prosecutor. That's not a just idea of a prosecutor.
What's that idea? Can you explain that?
Well, you know, prosecutors have a very specific ethical obligation to seek justice. The defense lawyer's ethical obligation is a little bit different, and it's to advocate zealously without breaking any rules for your client. But the prosecutor has a higher ethical obligation, which is to seek justice. I think that people who truly want fairness in the system, you know, none of us want guilty murderers to go free. That is not our goal. What we want to do is we want to make sure that the system is accurate, that constitutional rights are observed, that punishments are proportional, and that when cases don't need to be brought and that, or they're doing more harm than good, or there's a misallocation of resources, for example, with mass incarceration, those things do not go on. So it's actually pretty simple. I mean, if you define seeking justice broadly, as recognizing that the criminal justice system is just a part of a larger whole, then it becomes pretty obvious that mass incarceration is destroying schools and we're putting resources in the wrong place. That's the kind of talk you'll hear from progressive prosecutors, such as the one I hope to be, assuming I win this election in November. But it's not the kind of talk you've ever heard from the typical right-wing prosecutor who unfortunately has sort of defined what that's supposed to mean. All they want to talk about is more time, more incarceration. It's a lot of foot stomping and chest beating about how people who are convicted of something are inherently flawed and must do as much time as possible. It's exactly the mentality that's gotten us to this bad place.
Everybody likes a sharp-dressed man all the way down to what he's wearing closest to his skin. And if you're a man, well, Mack Weldon is better than whatever you're wearing right now. And that actually goes for the ladies too, because I'm talking about the men in your life. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. They've got a really great, clean website that makes it really easy to just click, choose, and check out quickly. And they've got the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants that you guys will ever wear. And they don't just look good and feel good, they actually perform, because they have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. You'll feel clean and comfortable all day. And they want you to be comfortable. So if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it and they will still refund you, no questions asked. Now, our listeners get a special offer for Mack Weldon. What you do is go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your entire order by using promo code undisclosed. Once more, it's MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using promo code undisclosed. That offer won't last forever, so check it out right now and take advantage of it. MackWeldon.com, promo code undisclosed.
You have a very broad and really exceedingly progressive agenda, which, frankly, I was very excited to read on your website. But among the many issues you're going to be looking at and kind of promises you've made, you have promised to cut down on the prosecution of minor cases. You plan on reviewing potential wrongful convictions, diverting drug addicts into treatment, and ignoring draconian sentencing guidelines, draconian by your own definition, abolishing money bail, and even declining to seek charges in a case that you would think are based on a legal stop and search. Now, I mean, that's not even all of it. But, you know, among all of these different issues, I mean, all these different kind of little links in the chain of criminal justice, and this is a question we get a lot, too. Like, what is the one issue you think is the most pressing in terms of its impact on the system? If you were to focus your resources first and foremost, where would they go on which of these issues?
Well, really, the unifying thread here is the criminalization of poverty. I mean, that is what has been going on in various different ways for a very long time. So if you're looking for the number one issue, that is the issue that flows through all of these particular points. Looking past that, I mean, to me, I guess probably the paramount issue has to be mass incarceration, because we do in the United States have five times as many people as were in jail in the 70s. And in Pennsylvania, which is usually a Democratic state, we have seven times as many people as were in jail in the 1970s. Let's understand, for a number of decades prior to the 70s, the incarceration level was fairly steady. So this is a radical departure from U.S. history to have so many people in jail. And, you know, I mean, we can go through the usual stats everybody's heard. You got 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prisoners in a country that claims to be the land of freedom and is pretty adamant that it's the land of freedom. That's a really big deal. And it's a really big deal because people like me who went to public schools in the 1970s, which I did, and had the possibility of a really good public school education in certain places with 22 people in that classroom, really don't have that anymore. I mean, in Philadelphia, if you go to a public school, you're going to see the dropout rate is exceedingly high, and you're also going to see 35 kids in a class. And it doesn't really matter how good the teachers are, because some of the teachers in Philadelphia are absolutely fabulous. But it doesn't matter, because they're trying to teach 35 kids, and that's totally unreasonable. And we are literally closing schools all over the city at the same time as we have this enormous prison population. Philadelphia is not only the poorest of the 10 largest cities, but it has the highest level of county incarceration of the 10 largest cities. And I do not see that as a coincidence. I think they are very directly related. Think for just one minute about the experience of someone living in an area of concentrated poverty, where in all likelihood in Philadelphia, you are predominantly dealing with black and brown people. Think about what it means that one in three black men will experience jail in their life. one in 17 white men, one in 18 black women, and one in some much larger number of white women will experience jail. It means that in those neighborhoods where since the 1970s, you've seen 19-year-olds go to jail for stuff that wasn't all that bad and then become unemployable for the rest of their lives, you have seen people turning to crime because of the way mass incarceration has broken down that neighborhood. It has broken down employability and family relationships and so on. And it just becomes, to me, abundantly clear that the key issue has to be to get away from mass incarceration.
So, I mean, you're talking about the link between poverty and mass incarceration, but you've also called the system, you've said that there is systemic racism in criminal justice. So can you talk about the link there, too? I mean, there is a definite link, as you said, between poverty, but then what's the link with race here?
Well, racially disparate outcomes are endemic in the system in many, many different ways. Perhaps one of the most obvious ways is that if you go to an area of poverty or an area of concentrated poverty, for example, in a city like Philadelphia, it will be disproportionately black and brown, and that those will be the places where we have police who are operating under orders to go and stop and frisk everybody. Without commenting on what happened with the Philando Castile case, it is worth remembering how many times this man was stopped in that car. I think it was over 50 times. This is a guy who's a cafeteria worker. Well, nobody's stopping me 50 times, okay? And I grew up kind of broke, but nobody is stopping me 50 times. They are stopping people because they are engaging in unconstitutional stop and frisk. They are not doing it in the affluent neighborhoods of Philadelphia or the predominantly white neighborhoods. They are doing it overwhelmingly in neighborhoods that are black and brown. And if you do that, then you're going to find the black and brown teenagers who have weed in their back pocket. You're not going to find all the white teenagers who, frankly, smoke tons of weed as well, who have it in their back pocket. And then you're going to start a process of getting them into criminal justice records, of making them unemployable, of having them lined up with fines and costs they can't always pay because they are, after all, poor. You're going to start this whole process that just puts up one barrier after another to people who are not fundamentally bad and are in many ways behaving no differently than people who are wealthier whiter but are getting better treatment. So to me, that's sort of where it really starts. But obviously there are, there have been studies done of implicit racial bias in district attorney's offices, including, for example, in New York. And they have found that while at certain steps in the process, there is no discrimination, at other steps in the process, there is. And that, for example, in drug cases in New York, they found that black defendants consistently got worse sentences than white defendants, that Latino defendants consistently got worse sentences. And this was true in a variety of different categories because, racism is real. It's not that someone like you or me or most Americans sits around and tries to be racist. But we are all, regardless of our color, we are all raised with certain racist thoughts and ideas and assumptions around us in the same way we are surrounded by germs. And we have to fight against those ideas and those assumptions in the same way that we have to stay clean and fight against germs, because that's how you stay healthy. So it's there and it's real and it manifests itself in many, many different ways. It is the evil twin of poverty. And as I said before, a lot of what goes on with the criminal justice system is simply the criminalization of poverty.
So you point to kind of the first, engagement of law enforcement with young people of color, and that is like in problematic policing practices. And I've read that the Philadelphia DA's office prosecutes 98% of cases brought to them by the police. So if you're already having, if there's issues in, like you said, illegal stop and frisks, unconstitutional search and seizures and all these things, and then 98% of these cases being brought to the DA are actually being prosecuted, number one, can you talk about why that specific, like that kind of statistic is a red flag for any DA's office, but also what kind of influence does a DA have on policing practices?
What you're talking about is sometimes referred to as the declination rate, the rate at which cases are declined when they're brought from a police department to the DA's office. And you're right. Right now it's about 3%, but ordinarily it's been about 2%. It is nothing but a rubber stamp. I've practiced in many different counties in Pennsylvania and in some other states. And there are a lot of counties where the rate of declining cases is much higher, you know, because they actually do thorough investigations, because they're not actually looking to break every kid that gets arrested. They're a little bit more careful about that. So that's actually a really key moment. Because it's the moment when you can overwhelm the court system with stupid cases that will make the people whose cases are stupid unemployable, or it's the moment when you can choose a different course, which would be, for example, diversion of people who meet the proper criteria and whose cases are just not that serious. You know, the people who in the 1970s weren't going to jail because the offenses were more like property crimes and things that were not terribly serious, or they were first offenses, things of that sort. So that's a really huge part of the task ahead, in my view.
I wanted to turn your focus kind of to the work that we do at Undisclosed, which is covering and examining wrongful convictions in different parts of the country. We do investigations into very specific cases, and then in a number of cases have uncovered evidence to help get defendants new trials. Now, this fall, we're covering a series of wrongful convictions that are all out of Philadelphia. And again, this is one of the issues that you are pledging to take a look at. But can you explain how or why the practices of the DA's office has historically hampered, like, overturning a wrongful conviction?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I'll try to give the short version of it. But, you know, this is a city where a police officer rose to be police commissioner, rose to be the mayor. And that was Frank Rizzo. He had a kind of a brutal and a racist approach to all of that. And his long shadow is still here. In fact, his statue is right across from City Hall. And he's the only modern mayor whose statue is across from City Hall. And there are a lot of things that he did that frankly put us in a position where the less progressive, the less racist elements in law enforcement were beat down. And the leadership in law enforcement was more like him. So, you know, that carried over into the DA's office, which in some ways was really not leading the charge. They were running behind the police department because that's just the culture in Philadelphia. And there have been periods of time, and I know this. I'm not talking about what might be. I'm talking about what I know. There have been periods of time when that shredder was running fast and hard over at the homicide division of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. I have heard with my own ears some rather well-known prosecutors, especially from around the early 90s when a lot of these wrongful convictions occurred. I have heard them say things to the effect of, why are you talking about innocence? If they didn't do this, they did something else, and they must be separated from society, which to me demonstrates almost an eagerness to convict people even when there are ample indications of innocence, just because in the opinion of the prosecutor, they're bad people, so we might as well get them anyway. It's pretty reprehensible, and some of those, you know, wrongful convictions were people who had no criminal record whatsoever. So exactly how they determined they were bad people based upon no criminal record whatsoever, I don't know, but I'm sure your listeners can probably figure out where that's coming from. So there has been this shadowy culture, frankly, in the district attorney's office for a long time. I am not saying that to suggest to you that all of those prosecutors are bad people, because they are not. But there's a lot of research about wrongful convictions and also about Brady violations and, you know, not turning over exculpatory evidence that tends to show that it's worse when the case is close, when there is pressure in a system that values convictions over everything else, as has happened too often in Philadelphia history, and the case is close, it is more likely that that statement, which introduces some doubt into the case, will be shredded. It is more likely that the jailhouse snitch will be motivated to come in and say things that, you know, a jury can't always accurately sort out. They do the best they can, but they can't even imagine some of the shenanigans that are possible. And that do occur in some cases, certainly not all cases. I will say this, and I think it's fair to say it. I know some prosecutors in the DA's office who are absolutely top shelf, incredibly ethical, and care deeply about innocence. But it's like anything else. It's not all of them. And the history here is bad.
Have you ever tried a Kind bar? Kind makes delicious, healthy snacks using whole ingredients you can both recognize and pronounce. If you're ready to try some tasty and healthy snacks, we've got a special deal for you. You can try 10 different full-size Kind bars for free. You just pay shipping. And when you sign up for the sample box, you'll also get to try Kind Snack Club. We receive monthly snacks at a discount and get members-only bonuses. The free sample box includes a wide variety of flavors, including a few of my favorites. The dark chocolate nuts and sea salt, caramel almond and sea salt, roasted jalapeno almond bar, and the dark chocolate chunk. So to try 10 different Kind bars for free, go to kindsnacks.com/undisclosed. You shouldn't have to choose between your health and taste when it comes to snacking. That's why both award-winning chefs and nutritionists love and recommend Kind bars. So visit kindsnacks.com/undisclosed to get your free sample box, and we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you help make this podcast possible.
I was happy to see that in the section on wrongful convictions on your website that you talked about, or you, at least you mentioned that, you know, there's patterns here that sometimes help identify what cases need to be looked at again. You know, patterns of police or prosecutorial misconduct. So we've got the same bad actors popping up over and over. And, you know, we discovered nearly a dozen wrongful conviction cases just right now, and I'm sure there are more, that are all connected by one, if not more, police officers in Philly. Yeah, but one of the frustrations in this kind of work is that, okay, you can identify these things, but what is the accountability for these officials? And it doesn't seem like there ever is accountability for that one or two bad cops that keeps popping up, the ones who coerce the witnesses or the DAs who withhold evidence. Do you think that there needs to be some mechanism of accountability in these cases?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I did in my career was in cases where we believe there was brutality or there was corruption. And these cases nearly always involved false reports by police. That, you know, I was involved in over 75 lawsuits against the police in cases where we saw corruption or brutality, and there were untruths being laid out by police to defend what they did or to conceal what they did. You know, I've also been involved in lawsuits against certain police officers who were taken to trial in federal court by federal prosecutors on corruption charges, and over 600 of whose convictions have been overturned since that time. So, you know, this is all stuff that is familiar to me, but the reality is that civil lawsuits are not a sufficient control on misconduct. We need to have a police department, and I don't control the police department, but we need to have a police department where discipline is real and firings are made with finality. That's not what we have. We have one where, unless a police officer is actually convicted and sent to jail, for the most part, any discipline that they receive will probably be overturned, and they're almost never fired. Even if the commissioner chooses to fire them, they're almost always put back on the police department. So there's not enough accountability in the disciplinary process. And frankly, we've had generations of district attorneys in Philly who had statutes they could have used to charge police officers with criminal activity. One, you know, one of them being, it is a crime to give a false report to police. Well, if you are a police officer who gives a false report to police, you committed that crime, and you could be charged with that, just as you could be charged with perjury in cases where there's video or there's other compelling evidence that shows that what you testified to is untrue and that it's pertinent and that it's not a mistake. But these haven't happened, and they haven't happened because district attorneys in Philly for the longest have been running for higher office and trying to feather their own nest rather than doing what the voters and taxpayers require.
Well, what about prosecutors themselves? What happens to a prosecutor who once, twice, repeatedly is found by court to have committed Brady violations?
I mean, unfortunately, what has happened is, for the most part, they're promoted. Not always, but there's, again, go back and look at the early 1990s. There are some prosecutors during that time whose convictions were overturned repeatedly because they would do things during closing arguments that were completely impermissible, and it would require the granting of a new trial. If you look at what happened to them professionally in the DA's office, they weren't demoted, they weren't fired. They remained, you know, at the highest level among the elite prosecutors in the homicide unit. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they were going to keep doing it because there was no accountability within that office. I mean, that's part of the reason I ran to be DA, because that's ridiculous.
So what would you do as DA if you found attorneys in your office to be either, you know, willfully withholding evidence or but just doing things that are that you're not comfortable with ethically?
I mean, it depends exactly on what they do. At the extreme, you charge them with crimes and fire them. You know, if you're dealing with situations where it's more a matter of ignorance as opposed to intent, then it may be something much milder, like a retraining, a demotion, something of that nature. It really depends on the circumstance. But if you're asking me what would I do if I knew that I had prosecutors who are destroying evidence, which is a crime, and would like to remain employed, they would be fired summarily, and they would be lucky if they weren't prosecuted themselves.
Is there also a mechanism for either the agency itself or defendants or even concerned citizens to make ethics complaints to like an ethics or bar association and impact the licenses of such attorneys?
There are mechanisms. They have not been used heavily in this particular. There are mechanisms. It is possible. And sometimes the ethics boards will listen a little bit more seriously if a referral is made, for example, by a judge, or if a referral relates to the handling of escrowed monies. The ethical board for attorneys takes very seriously any playing around with client monies and things of that sort. So I think it is something that can be used, but there isn't a long history of it being used effectively for this purpose.
Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030.
Okay. So I want to shift and talk a little bit about the link between politics and policy. And you mentioned that, you know, Pennsylvania is a blue state and Philadelphia is certainly a Democratic stronghold. Apparently, registered Democrats there outnumber Republicans 7-1. So it might seem that this would translate into the election of progressive officials and progressive policies, but it doesn't seem that way given the issues that you've identified that need desperate reform. So where's the disconnect? What happened?
This is a generational issue to some extent. We have a very different generation of voters right now than we had when I started as an attorney. You know, for example, and this is just an example, the Democratic Party has dominated in Philadelphia for a long time. And I, by the way, am a lifelong Democrat. I've always voted Democratic. But I am also a Bernie Democrat, meaning when I wasn't voting for Hillary, which I did, I was voting for Bernie. And we are generally referred to as progressives. And the Democratic Party in Philadelphia has not in the past embraced progressives, as one might hope. The consequence of this is the following. You have a system in which the Democratic Party has been dominant here for so many years that they haven't necessarily tried to bring out a lot of new votes because they weren't exactly sure whether those new votes would be good for the incumbents. This is nothing new to Philly. It happens all over the country. Unfortunately, the motivation of an incumbent politician is often to control the vote that got them elected. It's not necessarily to turn out the sometimes uncertain votes of new people, right? So, I mean, that's how you end up in a position where you have Donald Trump winning in Pennsylvania by only 40,000 votes because the party was pretty satisfied with controlling the vote they had. What happened with my election and with this campaign was really remarkable because even though I was only endorsed in about 10 out of 66 wards and the other 56 endorsed other candidates, we won 47 of those wards. Right. Even though in the last two election cycles, there were only about 105 to 110,000 total votes for the same type of election. This time there were 150,000 votes. So, I think a lot of what has happened and what is changing now in the Trump era is that you have pretty excited younger voters who have some strong feelings and want to participate. Bernie did, after all, get 46% of the national vote for Democrats, and he wasn't a perfect candidate, and he had real difficulty connecting with the African-American community, which is why he did not win the primary, ultimately. But what happened in Philly with this election was different. What happened in Philly with this election is the younger voters, the millennials of whatever stripe, but mostly white, turned out and held hands with African-American voters, especially African-American women, who are the most powerful voters in Philadelphia, to support somebody who's neither young nor African-American, and come to think of it, not female either. And, you know, it wasn't about personality. It really was about platform. I think at a certain level, it was about the millennials who like their gay marriage and they like their marijuana and they like their public schools and they don't particularly like being infinitely burdened by college debt. But they've heard of things like mass incarceration, and they are making decisions about their employment that are not always the most lucrative, but that involve principles they believe in. It was that group of people who were in some ways holding hands with an older generation, especially of African-American women, who've been through the experience of one of three black men experiencing jail, and also many of whom, the older ones, remember the civil rights era because they were part of it. And they know that change is possible because they were part of it. So you have the change is possible younger crowd holding hands with the change is possible older African-American crowd, especially women. And it is a vital force. It is for real. It is the grassroots as opposed to the political establishment. All political establishment really has to do is hug them. They just have to embrace it. It's there. Why on earth they didn't do it earlier, I don't know. But, you know, I'm looking forward to that happening because it will happen because the Democratic Party wants to survive.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question there is still like, what are the lessons? I think people are just still trying to figure that out. But, you know, my next question was actually about this past presidential election, because to me, it seemed like, and to many people, it seemed like in the last decade, like there was kind of a trend in criminal justice towards reform with, you know, bipartisan support for ending mass incarceration, mandatory sentencing, juvenile justice reform. It seemed like that was the trend. And then Trump gets elected. So I wanted to ask you first, you know, how do you think his election impacted the criminal justice conversation? Although I think your election speaks volumes to that. But also, I wanted to know specifically how policies out of the White House would have an impact on local issues that you would have to be dealing with.
Well, I mean, in many ways, I think Jeff Sessions, the sound coming out of Jeff Sessions' mouth is just the death rattle of the old guard. If anything, he's almost a perfect foil. Because he is such an old school racist, and because the nonsense coming out of his mouth about reinitiating a war on drugs and the nonsense coming out of Trump's mouth about just say no is so old and it's so failed. So in many ways, they are perfect foils for criminal justice reform because they're cartoon characters. And they really are cartoon characters. There is no third dimension there. So I think in many ways that is helpful. I mean, obviously he lost by the popular vote by 3 million people. He just happened to be a superstar when it came to the Electoral College and preying on the economic distress of certain voters in certain states. So I don't really see that as a terrible impediment. The most important thing to remember, though, about the interaction between chief law enforcement officer in Philly and chief law enforcement officer of the United States is that the United States government doesn't have all that many boots on the ground. The vast majority of criminal prosecution has always been done at the municipal and county level, where there are thousands and thousands and thousands of law enforcement that the federal government can't even match. So to some extent, a progressive district attorney, and there are a lot of us out there, can, to quote Trump, just say no. You know, we don't have, they can't tell us what to do. For the most part, we don't have to help them for free, for the most part. And district attorneys locally have broad discretion. You know, Sessions, he may love his liquor, but hate his marijuana. But the reality is he ain't going to be making the calls in Philly. If I'm lucky enough to be elected, I will. And I have no intention of making a big deal out of a substance that I think since about at least the late 1960s, everybody has known was no more serious than beer. I'm just not going to do that. He can huff and puff and do whatever he wants to do, but I'm just not going to do it. We're not going to spend our resources on that when we need to be solving homicides and we need to be solving shootings and we need to be solving rapes and we need to be doing the things that organically in a prevention model stop those crimes from occurring. And we're not going to be spending time chasing down weed. So if he wants to send some federal agents into Philly to run around and try to find kids with bags of weed in their back pocket, he can do it. But he doesn't have enough federal agents. He flat out doesn't have the people to carry out his draconian efforts at deportation and to carry out his draconian efforts to return to war on drugs. It will be up to us as local prosecutors, assuming I'm that lucky, it will be up to us to determine the real course of criminal justice reform until he is out. And he may be out very soon.
You make me feel so much better. We've been covering a lot of what Jeff Sessions is planning with some of his rollbacks. I know I only have you for a couple more minutes. I want to ask you quickly, can you tell us right now where the campaign stands? When is the election exactly? What day is the election?
The election is November the 7th. We are pushing very hard in that direction. It is the voters who pick DAs, so we're concentrating on the voters.
Speaking of which, that is going to be my final question to you. A lot of our listeners are so, so bothered by these issues, but they have no idea like what they can do. And I do urge them to, you know, get involved in electing reform-minded DAs. But, you know, what kind of advice do you offer listeners who want to be part of positive changes in criminal justice locally?
Well, there's the selfish advice, which is go to krasner4da.com, which is krasnerforda.com. And there's a lot of information there. And there's, I mean, we have the biggest volunteer army of any of these candidates. And there's a reason for it, which is the close connection between this campaign and me and activists and organizers for 25 years. I mean, the truth is that activists turn out to be better politicians than politicians. That's just a fact. So they can, either in Philadelphia or anywhere else, get close to the or be the people who are the activists and the organizers. They can think outside of the box and stop thinking that the only people who can run for DA are ex-DAs. That is a recipe for disaster. Certainly there are some excellent ones out there, but that is not the only resume that works, as I think has become increasingly clear in places like Philadelphia and Corpus Christi and elsewhere. And they can realize that there is tremendous power in the discretion of the local chief prosecutor, and they should push to have local chief prosecutors who will exercise that discretion in ways that are constructive rather than destructive. There is an effort across the country. It has been very successful in many different places, but one of the things that is most needed is the candidate who has a genuine message but also has a life history that makes that message credible. You need a genuine message and you need a credible messenger. And if you have that, you will have the people power, you will have the grassroots support, and you will win in many, many, many places. And then everything will change and it'll just be a better situation all around.
Well, thank you so much. We wish you all the best on behalf of Undisclosed and our listeners, and we'll be following the election. And this is going to air well before the election. So we'll also follow up with our listeners, and hopefully maybe I can come back and interview once you're in office.
That would be delightful. I'd love to do it.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Well, that is it for the addendum this week. Remember, all the case documents and photos are posted at undisclosed-podcast.com, as well as a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you all were so generous with last season. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod, and send any more questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I wanted to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for audio production. If you get a chance to listen to Crime Writers On, Rebecca Lavoie's fantastic podcast, please do. I want to thank Patrick Cortez for composing the addenda theme. And I want to thank Meethal Telhan, our project manager. And I'm looking forward to next week.